Sometimes I lay under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Petron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true. All right. Well, good afternoon, folks, and welcome back. Always a lively situation here, usually before we go on air. So we had some technical issues. I'm still not quite sure what happened, but I think we're on. At least two out of the three of us are. We'll hope that we get Rob before too long. But this is, yes, the Torah Teachers Roundtable. This is Mark Call here in Colorado, and we have online with us Mark Petron a little bit further east. And no sign of Rob yet. Like I said, we'll keep our eyes open. So, MP, let me embarrass you and say, hey, you got to talk for 2 hours since Rob's not here. What do you want to start with? How about the book of 2 Kings?
How about we start just at the beginning of 2 Kings 1?
Okay. Well, we kind of reviewed a little bit of that or got through some of it last week. But, it's a great book and a new book. So let's pick it up at least approximately in that vicinity.
Okie dokie. Well, why don't you go ahead and read the first two or three verses?
So Moab.
And I will comment, and we can yammer about that.
All right, and we'll continue. We'll go through this first part fairly fast. I know we got through about the middle of the chapter, at any rate. As we pick up the story, Moab has rebelled against Israel after the death of King Ahab. And then, and I remember Rob spent some time talking about, what the real meaning of the word here is in the Hebrew. Lattice is what it says. Ahaziah fell through, and he was injured. And he sent some messengers to go inquire, basically, of the Baal-zebub, right? A lord of the flies, king of Ekron, and whether I will recover or not. And the word goes to Eliyahu at this point, Elijah the Tishbite. And an angel from him, a messenger, goes and says, arise, meet the messengers of the king of Samaria. Say to them, is it because there's no God in Israel that you have to go and inquire of Baal-zebub, the king or the god of Ekron? Now, therefore, the prophet is told, you tell the guy, thus says Yahuwah, you shall not come down from the bed to which you've gone up, but you will surely die. So Eliyahu departed, and when the messengers returned him, he said to them, why have you come back? All right, so let's pause there, and again, we can go through this fairly rapidly, Mark, because we have talked about it through the middle of the chapter. Go ahead.
Okay. well, intro to the book is the Book of Kings is conventionally divided in printed Bibles into parts 1 and 2 for the sake of convenience, but in handwritten parchment scrolls of Sefer Melachim, it's all one continuous book.
Right, and most Hebrew versions of the Bible leave it the same way for that very reason.
Right. The division of the printed Bible at this point is relatively arbitrary since it happens to come near the middle of the book, and it actually comes in the middle of a parsha, a paragraph in the Hebrew text. However, the subject matter at the beginning of 2 Kings is a distinct continuation of the narrative at the end of 1 Kings, telling how Ahab, son of Ahaziahu, his son Ahaziahu came to the throne of Israel and continued to exactly the same path as his father and mother. So here we go in the commentary. When Ahab croaked, Moab took the opportunity to throw off the shackles it had worn since the days of David 175 years before. Now it says that in 2 Samuel 8:20, and he, that is David, smote Moab and measured them with a line, casting them down to the ground. Even with the two lines measured, he put to death, and with one full line to keep alive. And the Moabites became David's servants, bringing gifts. Okay, so now Moab came into Israel's vice Yehuda's service isn't readily apparent in the text, but the physical interposition of the Salt Sea between Yehuda and Moab makes geographical sense. I suppose that over the 175 years or so, the lack of physical barriers between Israel and Moab is what caused the situation. There is a mention of the events in verse 1 in a wiki article, so it's got to be true, on the ancient history of Israel and Yehuda, and it says this: Israel had clearly emerged by the middle of the 9th century BCE, when the Assyrian king Shalmaneser III names Ahab the Israelite among his enemies at the Battle of Karkar in 853 BCE. At this time, Israel was apparently engaged in a three-way contest with Damascus and Tyre for control of the Jezreel Valley and Galilee in the north, and with Moab, Ammon, and Aram Damascus in the east for control of Gilead. The Misha scroll in circa 860 or 830, left by King Moab, celebrates his success in throwing off the oppression of the house of Omri, that is Israel, and it bears what is generically thought to be the earliest biblical, extra-biblical reference to the name Yahweh. Now, that reference to the house of Omri means seems to mean Ahaziahu, Omri's grandson. In verse 2, Ahaziahu fell through a savach, a latticework cover, over an opening in the floor or an ornamental latticework railing around the perimeter of the roof, and presumably broke a bone or eight and took to his bed. When he didn't show any sign of recovering soon, Ahaziahu ordered a couple of messengers to go to Ekron to acquire of the priest prophet of Baal Zavuv if he would recover at all of his chala, that is weakness. Baal means to master or to take possession, while Zavav, which is the root word of Zavuv, to move to or fro like a moth or a fly, so it literally means master of flies. And Azamra has this: the king must have been seriously injured. True to form, he sent out to an Israelite prophet to find out his prognosis, and probably feared the answer that he would receive. But the priests of the cult of Zavuv, the fly god of the Philistine city Ekron, similarly in recent generations, many alienated Jews have been searching for spiritual meaning in every tradition except their own. It's very similar to the time of Ahaziahu. So that's where we got verses 1 and 2.
Okay, and like I said, we've already talked about a lot of this, so I won't add anything more. We're going to now go through
That's where I was finished last week, so.
Okay, good. The section continues with the messengers, and what's going to happen is kind of interesting and perhaps a little bit perplexing. The messengers returned to him, and he said to them, why you come back? Well, they said to him, a man came up to meet us, and he said to us, go, return to the king who sent you, and say to him, thus says Yahuwah, is it because there is no God in Israel that you're sending to inquire of Baal-zebub, the El of Ekron? Therefore, you shall not come down from the bed to which you've gone up, but shall surely die. Okay, well, that's what we just heard. They reported correctly.
Okay.
And then he said to them, what kind of man was it that you came and met and told you these words? As if he hasn't got maybe a bit of suspicion. So they answered, and they said, it's a hairy man wearing a leather belt around his waist. And he said, it's Eliyahu HaTishbi, the Tishbite. So then the king sent to him a captain of 50, along with 50 men. So basically he sent what would be in America, the Mueller response, to say, somebody who's on the Trump team, a SWAT team. He sends a SWAT team, and they went up to him. There he was, sitting on the top of the hill. And he spoke to him, and they said, man of God, the king has said, come on down. So Eliyahu answered, and he said to the captain of 50, if I am a man of Elohim, then let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men. And fire came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. So not exactly a great ending, not the usual SWAT team situation. Then he sent him another captain of 50 with his 50 men, having not learned the lesson. And he answered, and he said to him, man of God, thus has said the king, come down quickly. Oh, yeah, this time for sure. So Eliyahu answered, and he said to them, if I am a man of God, then let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men. And the fire of Elohim came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. Now, the Bible doesn't say it, but I will kind of include the word here, also. Two.
Also.
He consumed his 52. Not 52, but
exactly.
50 also. So then he sent a third captain.
Well, 51 altogether.
Yeah, he sent a third captain of 50 with his 50 men. Now, you got to pause. I'm wondering at this point, has the word spread? Are we beginning to see what's going on? And, you know, the rumors are spreading. You don't want to be part of that 50? Anyway, the third captain of 50 with his 50 men, and the third captain of 50 went up. He came down. This time, he has a different plan. He fell on his knees before Eliyahu, and he pleaded with him and said to him, "Man of God, please let my life and the life of these 50 servants of yours be precious in your sight. Look, fire has come down from heaven and burned up the first two captains and the 50s, captains of the 50s with their 50s, but let my life now be precious in your sight." So he starts to get it. This is a good place to pause. By the way, I think Rob is on board with us, so we'll say good afternoon, Rob. We started a bit back, and we're taking a run at where we ended up anyway. So a good afternoon, or actually very early good morning to you.
We are where I ended up, so I'm ready to go. Go ahead, Rob. Say hello.
Hello, everyone. I don't know what happened, but I got bumped off, and I'm back on.
All right. Well, this is good. We're happy about that. Marx is happy because he was worried he was going to be alone with me.
Yeah, that's trouble. That's trouble. When you get the two marks rolling together, you're in trouble. Anyway, let me cover verses 3-6, and we'll talk a little later. So, that the king was absolutely enthralled with his mother, Isabel, is totally persuaded to her gods is obvious. That Ahaziyahu would inquire of a god of a foreign nation, however, when there were prophets of Yehovah to inquire of, didn't go over well with Yehovah, so he spoke to not the king, but Eliyahu HaTishbi. He told him, "Kum ele, arise, get up," to confront the messengers of the king of Shomron. Zamra has this. He said, "For an Israelite king to do such a thing was a serious affront to the honor of God of Israel and his prophets, and this itself sealed the sick king's fate. In what was to be the last public mission of his ministry, Eliyahu the prophet was sent to intercept the king's envoys and tell them to tell him that he was going to die." Now, Yehovah did not use Ahaziyahu's name, but only his title. He instructed Eliyahu to say, in a marked paraphrase, "Is there no Elohim in Israel that you go to Ekron to inquire of the flies God? Now, therefore," that is, "because you, the king of Israel, are going up to ask your fate of some false Elohim, here's what I have to say. You will not be able to get out of your bed until the day you die, and that will be soon." Mark paraphrase, obviously. And then Eliyahu skedaddled. Ekron was almost due west of Jerusalem on a river wadi near the Great Sea. Ahaziyahu's messengers must have thought Eli's word would be good enough for the king, as it had been for them in verse 5, because they returned, shuved, their way a 2-3 day trip in 2.5 hours. And the king asked why they were back so soon. What turned y'all around? And they said, "Well, there was this guy who came up to meet us." Came up is a double use of the Hebrew Allah, which he came up, okay, to rise up or develop. The close repetition leads me to infer that he just seemed to appear to them as if out of a fog. Perhaps everyone listening to us has seen this happen in movies and TV. It sets a certain eerie mood. Okay? Now, so he appears out of this fog, which would get their attention. Now, I think the messengers told the story just as it happened, leaving nothing out. The word translated meet in the King James is kira, from the Hebrew kara, kara, which means to summon or to cause change in direction. I think the juxtaposition of these words in the messenger's account got Ahaziyahu's attention as well. These three words had the king actively listening to their story now. Now back to the messengers. So this guy came up, okay, to meet us. And he told us, "Go return to the king and say these words to him." Now the words "turn again" in the King James are from the Hebrew 7725 shuv, which means to return or to move backward. And it's the root of the word teshuvah, repentance. The messengers were given a chance of teshuvah. Part of that repentance would be delivering the message to the king. The king was not so fortunate. The messengers delivered the message, verbatim, I think, in a marked paraphrase. "Yahweh says, if there's no Elohim in Israel, that you had to send to the Lord of the Flies in Akron for a prophetic word? Here's your answer. You will not recover your health. You are going to die. Quote, unquote. That's what I think those guys told him, just like that. They told him just as plainly as they possibly could, and this is the king that they're talking to, and I don't think they're all that afraid. And I'm there. I'm through verse 6.
Okay, Rob, I know we've talked a little bit about this. You certainly have. Anything you want to add on the part that we've just reviewed?
No, I think I talked about it pretty good the last time. When they were discussing this, going to this God, Baal Zebub, we have a kind of a preconceived notion. I mean, to us, it's synonymous with devil. But obviously to them, at that time, it was not considered a devil. It was considered another of the pantheon of gods in the Canaanite region. So I think that what we're seeing here is this is a god that has a reputation of relieving plagues. And here...
if, when you need plagues relieved, go to Baal Zebub. I can hear the commercials practically.
Sure. And I think...
Yeah, I can see that too.
That for some reason, the king is convinced that it's going to be able to relieve his situation, even though his situation is not a plague. His situation was a critical injury. So we don't know if he got infected or whatever, but for some reason they think that Baal Zebub is going to be able to relieve the situation. Now, one Midrash said that they believed that he had gotten infected because of a fly. And so the maggots had started into the wound, and so that's why they had decided to go and talk to the Lord of the Flies. That could be true. It could be true. Things like that happened often. Herod, Herod the Great died from a worm infestation. And so here that could be the case. Whatever the case is, he decides not to inquire of Yahweh, but instead inquire of Baal Zebub of Ekron.
Hey, Rob?
Yes.
In the case of Herod the Great, do you think maybe he died from, let's say, maggots? Fly larvae?
Well, it could be. I think instead, probably what got him was worm infestation from eating pork.
Yeah, probably.
And that, if you eat pork, you're gonna get worms. But if you eat rancid pork or pickled pork, you're even more apt to get worms. And in the Romans' case, they loved, for whatever reason, they loved pickled pork.
Really?
And that's, they don't cook it, they just pickle it.
Oh, and, yeah.
And they just love that. And so that's probably what caused the worm infestation. But in this case, I think that there was a good chance that Akijah has a maggot infestation, and so he's seeking Baal Zebub's help. Obviously, he's got some control of the flies. And, okay. that may be...
Well, we got the picture, I think. So let's go ahead and continue.
Okay.
All right. So any comments on the fact that they keep sending guys who keep getting flamed on, and the third guy, at least, is smarter than the king, finally figures it out. Well, maybe he's in a position to say, the king is not the one who's you-know-what is on the line here. Mine is.
Yes. Yes. Well, the commander and the 50 men should have been plenty of men to capture one prophet.
You'd think, yeah.
Clearly.
Before you came on, I was referring to this as kind of the Robert Mueller approach, you know, the let's send a SWAT team to take out one old guy with, you know, with some hair and a leather belt. Turns out it wasn't. He was no pushover.
No, no. In fact, well, clearly Akashah.
Before we go there, can I catch up a little bit? I got some on verses 7 and 8. The the king and the guys that came to talk to him. Okay. The king asked what manner of man he was. Okay. It reminds me of 1 Samuel 8 when Shaul went to inquire of the witch of Endor. And when the woman saw Shemuel, she cried with a loud voice. And the woman spake to Shaul saying, why hast thou deceived me? For thou art Shaul. And the king said unto her, but be not afraid for what sawest thou? And the woman said unto Shaul, I saw gods ascending out of the earth. And he said to her, what form is he of? And she said, an old man cometh up covered with a mantle. And Shaul perceived that it was Shemuel. And he stooped face to the ground and bowed himself. Now, it's very, very similar kind of stuff. Ahaziahu has the same demeanor with his messengers that Shaul had with Shemuel. He was not treating them as servants. He was treating them as if they themselves were prophets. They answered him in verse 8, a hairy man with a leather girdle. TSK has this note. It says that he wore a rough garment, either made of camel's hair or that of John the Baptist or of the skin dressed with the hair on. Sir Hardin informs in a manuscript note on this place, that the Eastern dervishes and fakirs are clothed just as Elijah was, with a hairy garment girded with a leathern girdle. And Azamra has this about the hairy man. When the king heard the news and asked his envoys to describe the man who told them this, they said that he was a man of much hair with a leather belt girded about his loins. The abundant hair alludes to the exalted heights of Eliyahu's perceptions of God, and his girdled loins indicate his supreme moral purity and sanctity. If a true prophet of Jehovah dressed in such a way, doesn't it make sense that a false prophet for hire or a con man of some other god would dress this way to deceive his marks? Okay, the con man and his mark, get it? But no sooner had the king heard the description than he knew that it was Eliyahu the Hatishbi. Okay, so the king sends a couple of companies of cavalry.
Okay.
That's where we're at. I just finished verse 8.
Okay, so I'll ask again. Anything else on this section, or should we continue to read the story?
I've got stuff on the two companies of men.
Well, go ahead then.
But we're right near the end here, so I'm going to get a break.
Yeah, we've only got a few seconds, so we'll pause at that point. We'll pick it up here in just a minute, folks, after we get back from the bottom of the hour break. And we should have music, but hey, things have been messed up all day, so maybe
I think we still have 40 seconds. Anyway,
okay.
King sent a company of cavalry to intimidate Eliyahu Hatishvi. When they arrived in Eliyahu's presence, as if they're going to do it, he was sitting on top of a hill. Cavalry can go up a hill to fight, but they are best on more or less level ground. So the captain called up to him, Man of Eloha, the king says come down. Eliyahu then recalled his encounter with the 450 prophets of Baal and answered the captain in verse 10, If I am a man of Eloha, let fire come down out of the sky and consume you. And what to the captains and the company's eye should appear? Consuming fire from on high.
All right. Well, we're at the break now, so we finally got there. We'll be back.
Don't kick me soon, cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say, and our children will pay. One million quid.
Do-do-do-dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Dum. Come-a-come-a-dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum, do-be-do-dum-dum. Keepin' Torah's a joy to do. Let's say that bound by the law, the 16 and many more. Don't they know what's really true? Yeshua double me and you. I keep the peace and Shabbos too. 6,000 years old, it's not.
Welcome back now to the second half hour of the first hour of the Torah Teachers Roundtable. We're talking about the book of 2 Kings now, or actually the second half of the single book, as it is in the original scriptures. When we went to the break, we interrupted MP having to do with, I'm not sure where he was, but a whole bunch of guys that seemed to keep going back and getting get burned up as a result of dissing Eliyahu. Go ahead, Mark.
Okay. Yeah, well, the last thing that I said was, and what to the captains and the company's eyes should appear but a consuming fire from on high. Now, I think that the horses found their ways home, riderless, and since there was nothing left of the company or their captain. Now, Moshe said back in Deuteronomy 4:23-24, take heed unto yourselves, lest ye forget the covenant of Yehovah Elohechem, which he made with you, and make you a graven image, the likeness of which Yehovah Elohecha hath forbidden thee. For Yehovah Elohecha, a consuming fire, a jealous Elohim. And then in Deuteronomy 9:3, he says, understand therefore this day that Yehovah Elohecha, he which goeth over before thee, a consuming fire, he shall destroy them. And he shall bring them down before thy face. So shalt thou drive them out and destroy them quickly as Jehovah hath said unto thee. This was Israel's history as well as our own. They had Torah teachers. Their late king, among the most knowledgeable of all the Torah scholars in the world, and this should have been in the backs of their minds at least. So in verses 11 and 12, seems like deja vu all over again. Maybe the horses of the first company didn't even go home immediately. Whatever, Ahaz Yahu sent another company of cavalry to send the message to Eliyahu. The king, the captain delivered the king's message, just as had the first captain, and Eliyahu gave him the same reply, and the company got to see their destruction come to them, just as had the first company. If you haven't guessed it yet, seen it yet, rather, look on YouTube for Dr. Edward Fudge's teaching sermon entitled The Fire That Consumes. It's a brilliant one-hour video that destroys the idea of an eternal hell and a sadistic God that would think of it. Remember that if you want to destroy a person's reputation, the easiest way to do it is to accuse him of what you are guilty of yourself. Hasatan and the leftist Democrats through the mainstream media have come immediately to my mind. And that's exactly what the prophets of all the false gods are. Tearing down Yehovah and saying that they're all that and a bag of chips. That's what I got through verse 12.
Okay. You actually almost lost me there for a second. So your point is with respect to the story, what was your point? You know, Eliyahu
is killing all these guys. Yeah, I referenced earlier that the horses and all of their stuff probably got back without any problem. What I'm saying is that the guys were consumed. The horses were innocent. They weren't consumed, is the way that I'm thinking. Okay? Those guys were consumed completely. There's nothing left of them anywhere. And that's the way that the lake of fire will be. And I think that that's, and the idea that hell is the lake of fire, or the lake of fire is hell, is just unimaginable to me. Yehovah would not punish somebody for all of eternity future because he lived 70 years without following him. Just can't see it.
Okay. Well, all right. Interesting.
That's not a merciful Yehovah.
Well, and of course, I will frequently just simply remark that, with the exception of the Lake of Fire reference and references like this, there is a big difference between the, if you will, Romanized, paganized conception of hell with the little guy with the pitchfork and the red suit and the pointy horns and all that kind of jazz, and words like either Gehenna, which referred to the trash pit outside of town where the trash was burned. Or to Sheol, the other reference, and Sheol usually just is translated as death or the grave. Okay, Rob, how about you? You want anything on this?
Yes, the term hairy man, the Aishar, it. It's been translated, as we said, hairy man, but it literally means possessor of hair. And this description more likely refers to the camel hair tallit that he wore, according to Zechariah 13:4, clenched around his waist with a leather belt. And this tallit would be passed on to Elisha, and identifying Elijah by his tallit also connected him to the ministry of Rav Yohanan HaMikbil, or John the Baptist, who dressed in the camel hair tallit, according to Matthew 3:4. When the priests and the Levites saw him, they asked, "Are you Elijah?" in John 1:19-21. So this was a celebrated tallit, and it virtually will last forever, being camel hair. And that's not unusual. I actually got to see a camel hair tallit in Israel. A friend of mine introduced me to a man that had one made in out of camel hair. We tend to remember the old army blankets of World War II made out of camel hair because they're durable and can last, as I said, forever.
Yeah, well, anyway. Not always the most comfortable.
Were those made from camel hair?
Huh?
I say, were those made from camel hair?
Yes, they were made out of camel hair.
Okay. I know they were wool, but I didn't know they were camel wool.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And like I say, they last forever. And they get softer with use. And this one has really been used. So anyway, talking about this group of 50 men. One commander and 50 men should have been plenty of manpower to arrest a prophet, especially an old prophet. Well, clearly, more men than were normally required. The commander here admitted the righteousness of Elijah when he called him a man of Elohim. Therefore, they were wrong in doing this, even though they were on orders from their king. Scripture clearly teaches that we owe submission to the government and governing authorities, yet in the human sphere, the spiritual command to submit is never absolute, but always conditioned by their greater responsibility to submit to Yahweh, according to Acts 5:29. This commander should have resisted the ungodly and immoral command from King Achaziah to arrest Elijah and obey Yahweh instead. His 50 men should have refused to obey the ungodly, immoral command of their commander. Rebellion to tyranny is obedience to Yahweh. If I am, in fact, a man of Elohim, let fire come down from heaven and burn you up, along with your 50 men. Elijah put the issue in stark contrast. If he were a man of Elohim, then the commander and his 50 men were on an ungodly, immoral mission. Since Elijah could not bring fire down from heaven without divine approval, he asked Yahweh to evaluate these men and the rightness of their actions against the prophet. You say, "I am a man of Elohim," even though you're not acting like it. Maybe I'm not. Let's let Yahweh decide by fire. The insult was less against Elijah than against Elijah's Elohim. Some have criticized the prophet for destroying these men, but they do not consider that it was not possible for Elijah to bring fire down from heaven. Yahweh alone could send the fire, and he is just and good. He would not have destroyed these men had not there been a sufficient cause to justify the action.
Same thing with the 450 prophets of Baal.
Yes.
It was purely justified by Jehovah. So go ahead.
So fire came down from heaven and burned them up and his 50 men. So the commander that ordered Elijah to come down, the man of Elohim, couldn't come down because Yahweh didn't command him to do so. But fire of heaven did. Yahweh brought judgment on these men who acted as if Yahweh was not a real Elohim and as if Elijah was not truly his servant. Wiseman notes, and I like this note, it must be noted that the demands made of Elijah were wrong. A king had no right to ask such allegiance, and his actions should always be subordinate to Yahweh's word. Yahweh was protecting his word, his name, and his servant. And this is very big because his name is on the line. Remember, the king has gone to Baal-zebub to inquire and to get healing.
Yep.
Yahweh, his namesake, he is Yahweh Rapheka. And so his namesake, is he a miraculous Elohim? Can he heal? Yes, he can. If he can kill, he can heal. And so here, Yahweh is showing himself to be the supreme Elohim, in fact, the only Elohim.
Right.
So the king sent him another commander of 50 together with 50 men. The second commander repeated the same error as the first commander. Well, but with even more guilt because he knew what had happened to the first commander. The judgment upon the first group should have warned the second commander and his 50 men. You think?
Yeah.
You can hear the fear in the order of the second commander. Come down immediately. He wanted to get in, apprehend the fugitive, and get out without casualty. Elijah's response is the same. If I'm a man of Elohim, let fire come down from heaven and burn you up along with your 50 men. Elijah left the matter in Yahweh's hands again, and Yahweh responded in dramatic judgment. Fire came down from heaven, and it burned him up, and his 50 men. So the king sent a third commander of 50 and his 50 men.
This guy's a little smart.
The third commander approached his mission with a completely different manner. The third commander of 50 climbed up, approached Eliyahu, fell on his knees before him, and pleaded with him. So he came to Elijah humbly, recognizing that he was really a man of Elohim. Man of Elohim, please have some regard for my 50 men and my life too. We are servants of yours. I know that fire came down from heaven and burned up the two other commanders and their 50 men, but now have some regard for my life. Perhaps the third commander looked at the two blackened spots of scorched earth nearby before he spoke to Eliyahu. The angel of Yahweh said to Eliyahu, go down with him, don't be afraid of him.
Right.
It wasn't that Yahweh didn't want Elijah to go to King Akijah. It was that Akijah and his commanders and their soldiers all acted as if Yahweh had no sovereignty in Israel. When the request was made wisely and humbly, Elijah was allowed to go. There are many reasons why Akijah wanted to arrest Elijah, even though he already heard prophecy through Elijah. Perhaps he wanted Elijah to reverse the word of doom and would use force to compel him to do so. Perhaps he just wanted to show his rage against this prophet who had troubled him and his father, Ahab, for so long. Perhaps he wanted to dramatically silence Elijah to discourage future prophets from speaking boldly against the king of Israel. Yahweh assured Elijah.
Yes, that one backfired, huh?
Well, that's the more typical one we see nowadays. You know, that's the Facebook methodology, or what we've seen so many times with Big Brother. This will shut everybody else up so that they don't get uppity and get out of hand.
Well, I think that was the whole meaning of Congress in trying to silence the president, because the legislative branch is still trying to assert their power over the executive branch. And they have a good history, because most of the time the executive branch, well, for a long time, the executive branch had almost a figurehead position. And the legislative was the stronger branch. Not to beleaguer the point, but it seems like that they're still trying to assert their power, that they are greater than the executive power, and to silence anyone that would try to come up against them. And they're doing a pretty good job so far. Even going so far as to without precedent, they're threatening to arrest the attorney general and put him in prison without due process.
Right.
Even though they don't have a prison, and it's never been done before, so they're not real sure how to get the sergeant of arms of the Congress to do it.
There are holding cells in the basement of the Capitol building.
Yeah, but not for long-term incarceration.
Exactly. Exactly. Not supposed to be. Anyway.
It's always been used in the past to protect the witness from outside influence or for whatever reason they feel threatened. So you put them in the holding cells until they testify.
Right. But, so they can't be Seth Rich or whatever the equivalent may
right.
be.
But now they're wanting to use this in such a way to assert that they have enough power to back up their subpoenas. It's always been a bit vague. Do they have the power to back up their subpoenas, especially against the attorney general? Normally, in the normal situation, they would turn to the attorney general to enforce their subpoenas. But they can't, because the attorney general is the one they're trying to subpoena, and he's telling them, I don't have to go.
Yeah, the only way that they can enforce anything that they do is if it's done on the Capitol Hill.
Okay.
That's their domain.
I'm starting to think, gee, I probably shouldn't have suggested anything outside of the flow because we get there. But suffice it to say, this is the point I usually try to make. Ain't nothing new under the sun. What has been is what shall
That's
be done, and we're seeing that. The same arrogance, the same disregard for either the law of the land or the creator of that law and the God that is supposed to be in control and so forth still applies.
That's right.
That was the point Rob was making. He was just using that as illustration.
Yeah. I'm aware of that. So we're there.
Yeah. Martin Petron, Mark Call is not near as vague and unattached as you think he is. See, he's right on the money. He knows what we're talking about.
Oh, he does? Okay, I just
Most of the time he does. Every now and then, I'll confess, you guys will kind of leave me out there in the weeds, and I'm going, where are they headed? But this time, for sure, we're okay.
Yes. Okay.
Yep. So, in verses 13 through 18, the king sends another company of cavalry. And you can see by Ahaziah's actions that he has little or no respect for the men that served him. He sent 102 men to the men of Elohah, and all of them were devoured by nuclear fire. The removal of the strong and the weak nuclear forces, I think, okay, is just gone, okay? Allowing the protons to disperse and the electrons to meet them and send them, whatever. They just don't physically exist anymore. what happened to these 102, in my not-so-humble opinion, is a lake of fire in microcosm. They were eternally dissolved at the nuclear level. Horses, saddles, bridles, and other accoutrements left right where they were, and perhaps not even getting warm to the touch. But this captain of this company made Aliyah. Okay, he's falling on his knees and he's submitting himself to the man of Elohim, not demanding that Eliyahu HaTishbi submit to his authority, and beseeching Eliyahu to let the lives of his company be precious before his eyes. He acknowledged in verse 14 that his predecessors, literal predecessors, okay, had come to an early and dazzling demise because they had despised Jehovah and his prophet. When dealing with Jehovah and his sold-out servants, a little humility can go a long way. Okay, it says in Yeshayahu 66:2, "For all those hath mine hand made, and all those hath been, saith Jehovah. But to this will I look, to the poor and to the contrite heart, and that trembleth at my word." Ruach HaKodesh saw in verse 15 this man's humility before Eliyahu, and told his servant that he could trust this one. Don't fear this one. Go with him. And Eliyahu obeyed. I don't think that Eliyahu was afraid of anyone anymore. So he was escorted to the king by a company of cavalry. He's escorted to the king. He's not being forced to go. Okay? Zamra on the third company commander said this: "Only the more respectful attitude of the third captain mollified heaven sufficiently to send prophecy to Eliyah to appear before the king and castigate him directly. For those who honor me shall I honor, and those who despise me shall be despised," in 1 Samuel 2:30. Now that the kings of Israel had gone astray, their moral authority was discredited, while Elohim himself would vindicate the authority of his true prophets. Okay, so then in verses 16 and 17, Eliyahu prophesied to the king, who is only named again after his death in the referral to his other adventures as the king of Israel. In a marked paraphrase, this is what Eliyahu said: "Because you sent to Ekron to get a vision from Baal-Zebub, there must not be an Elohim in Israel to inquire of, and for that reason, you will not recover. You will surely die." And Zamra has this to say on that. It says, "With his fate sealed, Ahaziyahu died, and having no children, was succeeded by his brother Jehoram, son of Ahab. This initiated a period in which the kings of Israel and Yehuda both had the same name, since Jehoshaphat, king of Yehuda, also had a son named Jehoram. Anyway, we'll meet him soon enough." That's what I got on the rest of this chapter.
Okay. Rob, anything?
Sure. So
okay, only 2 minutes. So hopefully you got long enough. Go ahead.
So Eliyahu said to the king, "Here is what Yahweh says: You sent messengers to consult Baal-Zebub, the god of Ekron. Is it because there's no Elohim in Israel that you consult this foreign god? Therefore, you will never leave the bed you're lying on, and you'll certainly die." Amen. So he died in keeping with the word of Yahweh spoken through Eliyahu. So this was the same message Elijah gave to the man, to the men Echishah had sent to inquire of Baal-Zebub. The message from Yahweh didn't change just because Echishah didn't want to hear it the first time. Echishah died according to the word of Yahweh which Eliyahu had spoken. The proof was in the result. Elijah was demonstrated to be a man of Elohim because his prophecy was fulfilled just as he spoke it. Akijah did not recover from his fall through the lattice. Akijah achieved nothing but ruin and failure. He let Moab rebel. He hurt himself in a clumsy accident. He foolishly attempted to use military force against Elijah. And worse, he sought help in the wrong place, in Philistia, at the altar of a pagan god, Baal-Zebub.
Okay, we are at the break, so we'll pick it up with chapter 2 when we get back.
And I pray, don't take me soon, cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds,
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself and see if these things be true. Welcome back now, folks. Second hour of the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Tanakh edition, and the Book of Second Kings, second chapter at this point, where we're going to see a very famous, I guess you'd say, end of Eliyahu or Elijah's time on earth. Everybody knows what's going to happen here, but we'll go ahead and go through it and to talk about the details. Now, let me read the first couple verses in the next chapter anyway, which says, "And it came to pass, when Yahuwah was about to take up Elijah or Eliyahu into heaven by a whirlwind, that Eliyahu went with Elisha from Gilgal. And then Eliyahu said to Elisha, 'Stay here, please, for Yahuwah has sent me on to Bethel.' But Elisha said, 'As Yahuwah lives, and as your soul lives, I'm not going to leave you.' Now, the sons of the prophets who were at Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, 'Do you know what Yahuwah, or do you know that Yahuwah will take away your master from over you today?' He said, 'Yep, I know. Keep silent.'" Okay, so let's pause. That's a good place to stop and ask, okay, what's happening here, and give some background and so forth. Let's go to Rob first. So what do you think, Rob, if your mic's on?
I'm trying to get there. Okay. Well, the Eliyahu, well, that doesn't bring us to where we're supposed to be. Yehoram was also the son of Ahab, and therefore the brother of Akijah. Akijah had no descendants to pass the kingdom on to, so the throne went to his brother after the brief reign of Akijah. It says, Akijah began to rule in the place of him during the second year of Yehoram, ben Yehoshaphat, king of Yehuda, because he had no sons. Other activities of Akijah are recorded in the annals of the kings of Israel. So the account became a little confusing here, because the king of Yehuda at the time was also named Yehoram, ben Yehoshaphat. So it brings us to Elisha becoming the center of the attention. Elijah has been the dominant force in our story. So now Elisha ben Shaphat. Shaphat was a wealthy landowner of Abel Meholah. He became the attendant and disciple of Eliyahu Hanavei. His name first occurs in the command given to Elijah to anoint him as his successor. After learning in the cave at Mount Horeb that Elisha ben Shaphat had been selected by Yahweh as a successor in the prophetic office, Eliyahu sent out to find him. On his way from Sinai to Damascus, Eliyahu found Elisha. One of them that were plowing with 12 yoke of oxen. Elisha delayed only long enough to kill the yoke of oxen, whose flesh he boiled with the wood of his plow. Eliyahu went over to him, threw his talit over Elisha's shoulders, and at once adopted him as a son, investing him with the gift of prophecy. Elisha accepted this call about 4 years before the death of Israel's king Ahaz. After he had shared this farewell repast with his father, mother, and friends, the newly chosen prophet went after Eliyahu and ministered unto him. For the next 7 or 8 years, Elisha became Eliyahu's close attendant until Eliyahu was taken up into heaven. During all these years, we hear nothing of Elisha except in connection with the closing scenes of Eliyahu's life. on the day Yahweh had selected to take his servant Eliyahu from this earth, the prophet left Gilgal in the company of his disciple Elisha. They reached the shores of the Jordan, followed by 50 young prophets who had come with him out of Jericho and stood watching them at some distance. Now, the time came for Yahweh to take Eliyahu up into heaven in a whirlwind or a tornado. Eliyahu and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal when Eliyahu said to Elisha, "Please wait here, because Yahweh has sent me all the way to Beit El." But Elisha said, "As Yahweh lives and as you live, I'll not leave you." So they went down to Beit El. The school of the prophets of Beit El here, because he had sent came out to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that Yahweh is taking your master away from you today?" "Yes, I know," he answered. "Say no more." Eliyahu said to him, "Elisha, please wait here, because Yahweh has sent me to Jericho." He replied, "As Yahweh lives and as you live, I'll not leave you." So they came to Jericho. The school of the prophets of Jericho approached Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that Yahweh is taking your master away from you today?" "Yes, I know," he said. "Say no more." Eliyahu said to him, "Please wait here, because Yahweh has sent me to Jordan." And he replied, "As Yahweh lives and as you live, I'll not leave you." So Elisha did not want to face the fact that he was losing his mentor. For the past years, Eliyahu had taught Elisha all the mysteries of the Torah.
Amen. Amen.
Okay.
I
have to ask, because when I read that, I can't help but think, is there more to it? Is that the only reason? And I don't find that real satisfying, Rob. I tend to think there's another reason here that he's not willing to be left. If for no other reason, the obvious one is, hey, I want to see what's going to happen to this guy. This is going to be one of those cool things. I think when he goes, I'd like to be there and watch. I mean, maybe there's other explanations too, but that one certainly strikes me.
What strikes me about this story is that the school of the prophets at Beit El and the school of the prophets at Jericho all knew in advance that Yahweh was taking Eliyahu up.
That's right. Everybody knows.
Absolutely.
Yes. It's strange, because there's no way to know, but they know. So the only way they could have known was through the gift of prophecy.
That's right.
It's interesting. Elisha's like, "Oh, yeah, I got that message. Just shut up. Shut up about it. I don't want to hear about it. Just be quiet." Like it's that, like not talking about it might change the outcome. And that's generally when someone is in denial, that they'll say, okay, I don't want to hear about it. Okay, just shut up about it, okay? And that seems to be what Elisha is doing here. He's also received the message from Yahweh that Eliyahu is going up, and that's why he doesn't want to leave him. And it appears to me that he's hoping the outcome will change. And you can understand it. He doesn't want to leave his spiritual father. And that would be hard, because that would mean that now everything rests on his shoulders. And it hadn't been fun. You know, they're in rebellion to the king. They are the dissenting voice to the mechanism that the king of Israel is trying to move from a representative monarch to a totalitarian dictator. And this is into a supreme monarch. And it's kind of interesting. We just heard from the news there that the president of China had moved from being a representative president to being president for life. I mean, he can't be removed from office, and he cannot be voted in or out.
Oh, wow. All over again.
Right. And so they have precedent in China. We don't have precedent.
Well, and that's actually kind of old news, isn't it? because we've been hearing about that for a while.
Yes, but the news that the Democrats like to stir up is the fact that President Trump seems to be enamored with that office. You know, that, oh, wow, you're president for life. Well, then you don't have to mess with the legislative branch of the Communist Party, do you? And he, you know, I take away from that. It's not that he wishes it. He was president for life, because I don't think he wants to be president for life. I think what he's saying is, you don't have to mess with the jackals like I do.
That would seem to be obvious, actually. Yeah. Can't say that I would blame anybody for wanting to not deal with the kind of criminals that are running the house at this point.
Uh huh. And so, in this case, you see Elijah wanting to, or Elisha wanting to, not lose the stronger of the two of them, the two men. You know, he knows that. That right now, the prophet of Yahweh that descends from the king has got a bounty on his head. Remember, we've just seen the commanders coming out trying to apprehend him, to arrest him, and probably his doom would have followed suit. But Yahweh stepped in. So Elisha's like, do I want this office? Do I want to deal with all of this controversy. Yeah. And so he's like, let's not talk about it. I'm staying with him at his side. Like he thought maybe that when he did go up, he would grab on to his tallit and hold him back to earth, you know, and keep him from going. You can only read through the lines at what Elisha might have thought. And I think at the point, he doesn't really know what he wants to do. He just doesn't want it to happen. And that brings us to the seventh verse.
Okay. Can I cover the first two?
Sure.
I mean, verses 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. Okay. Elisha was first seen, for us, he was first named anyway, in 1 Kings 19 and verses 15 through 19, when Eliyahu was in his great self-imposed trial of faith in the cleft of the rock in Sinai, or perhaps it was Rephidim, whatever. In 19:15 through 19, it says, "And Jehovah said unto him, Go, return on thy way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when thou comest, anoint Hazael, king of Syria, and Jehu, the son of Nimshi, shalt thou anoint king of Israel, and Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, shalt thou anoint prophet in thy room. And it shall come to pass, him that escapeth the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay, and him that escapeth the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. Yet I have left 7,000 in Israel, all the knees which have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth which hath not kissed him." So he departed thence and found Elisha, son of Shaphat, plowing with 12 yoke before him, and he with the 12. And Eliah passed by him and cast his mantle upon him. Now, how many years before Jehu appears in Scripture was that? Okay. How many years before that? Okay. Jehu appearing in Scripture. Jehu ben Nimshi is at least 2 to 3 kings of Israel from that point in chapter 19 and verses 15 to 20. So, or to 19. So Ahab was king of Israel at the time, and above quoted prophecy, when he has at least 3 or 4 years left in power. Then his son Ahaziahu would reign for parts of 2 years, let's say between 10 and 18 months on the throne of Shamron. Jehoram would reign for about 12 years before he was killed in battle, and Jehu reigns in his stead. So somewhere between 17 and 20 years transpire between 1 Kings 19 and 2 Kings 9, when Jehu kills Jehoram and Isabel in the same day. talk about a quick power consolidation. Eliyahu is supposed to anoint Yehu King Ben Nimshi, king of Israel, according to the prophecy of 1 Kings 19. So either there has been a rather lengthy space in the narrative, or there are still about 12 years and 7 chapters before Eliyahu can perform the work of Yehovah. In other words, if Eliyahu is taken in the whirlwind, and he is, then he was not translated, as in raptured, out of the earth, and there goes that proof text, doesn't it? I think we see Eliyahu going into something like a retirement. Maybe he'll go to the villages in Florida for a while. By the way, Elisha is a contracted form of Elishua, my God saves, which could also be seen as El Yeshua, just saying. Zamra has this intro. They say, Eliyahu had already asked to be relieved of his ministry of zeal and fire in 1 Kings 19:4, and now he was taken up to heaven in a chariot of fire. The narrative of Eliyahu's ascent in our present chapter contains many teachings about the nature of prophecy. Eliyahu tried to persuade his disciple Elisha not to follow him, but Elisha knew prophetically that his master was to be taken from him in verses 3 and 5, and refused to leave his side. The other prophets who came out to meet him also knew that Eliyahu was about to ascend to heaven, Ibid, okay? But for the departure from earth of Tzadik Hador, the righteous leader of the generation, was an event of the greatest significance, even though ordinary mortals may have been quite unaware of it. Okay, so that's the end of Azamra's commentary now. In verse 2, Eliyahu asked Elishua to hang around and the homestead while he goes under orders to Beit El. But Elisha told him that he would also go down to Beit El. Now, Beit El is just over and on the west side of the ridge between Yarden and the Great Sea, the Mediterranean, while Gilgal is physical elevation is just above the river Yarden, at the foot of the central highlands of Ephraim's inheritance near Jericho. Beit El is perhaps 1,500 feet higher, maybe 2,000 feet higher in elevation than Gilgal, perhaps more, and in Benjamin, and a part of the Yehudi kingdom. So how are they going down to the house of El, to Beit El, where a bunch of Yehovah's prophets are? Was there a Moad approaching? Down is from the Hebrew Yarad, which means to descend. In the physical and in the spiritual, I think, they are doing Aliyah. They're going up. Now, perhaps Gilgal, being Eliyahu's base, when he went anywhere, he was going down in a physical sense. Okay? Yeah. In a spiritual sense, rather. Maybe one of my more learned colleagues can address that. Do you think it's possible that we're talking in two different spheres of existence here, in the spirit and in the physical? Now, he's going down to Beit El, but he's got to go up 2,000 feet or more to get there. That's where I'm coming from.
Right.
Any possibility about that?
Normally, you go down when you're coming from the direction, say, of Galilee or Shimron. You're coming down to Beit El because you're higher up.
Yeah.
In the northern part of Israel.
Well,
and you go down towards the Dead Sea. It gets lower and lower and lower as you're going towards
right.
the Dead Sea.
That's where I'm coming from.
But the
that's
other physical. Standard understanding is just that when you head towards Jerusalem, you're going up, regardless of what calendar direction you're headed is. And I've heard any number of times as well.
Right. Jerusalem is up from the peak of Mount Everest as far as places on the earth go. That's the most important place there is.
Well, it is higher. It's higher than the Jordan Valley.
Oh, yeah. Way higher.
Jerusalem sets up on several hills. And so that's going up. But when you're going towards Beit El, you're going down towards the Jordan Valley, even though Beit El sits up higher than, say, the other area. It's still lower than on a level playing field. It's still lower than Jerusalem, and it's lower than Jericho.
Well, now wait a minute. Jericho is in the Rift Valley. It's below sea level. And Beit El is probably 1,200 or 1,500 feet above sea level.
But when you go, when you're there, it's up on a high hill.
Right.
So as you're going, as you're scooting along the Jordan Valley, you do have the feel of going down, not going up. So that could be the reason why. That could be the reason why that they're talking about going up or down.
Yeah, they're going down to Beit El from Gilgal, which is quite literally only 30 or 40 feet higher than the Jordan River itself.
Well,
and we're almost to the Dead Sea. This is the lowest place on earth.
Wait a minute.
Place on earth.
Wait a minute. That not according to what Dr. Vendel Jones, who actually found Gilgal, it's not in the Dead Sea Valley. It's north of Beit El.
It's north of it, but it's still below sea level there.
And so I've been to the site of Gilgal, and you do have the sense that you're going down towards Beit El and Shiloh. It does feel like you're going down. Now, I don't know what the elevation is technically, but you do have the sense of going down. Then when you get to Beit El, you go up towards where the city is. And that's not unusual because most cities are built up on a hill in Israel, hence the term tel. They generally cover the city once it's been conquered with dirt and make a full hill out of it. And that's why you have other cities being built on top of other cities, because they fill it in once it's been destroyed. They just fill it in with dirt to erase the memory of the city. And often people will come back, refugees will come back and build again on top of the old city. Now that's kind of what happened with Jericho, except that Jericho has three sites. There's not just one Jericho. There's the ancient Jericho that was destroyed by Yahweh, that's not inhabited, that's just there. The ruins are there. You can see them. And then just a ways from it, you see another Jericho. And then from that, you see another Jericho, both another one in ruins, and then the modern city today of Jericho. But they're all within sight of each other. So you can see that, and that's why that Jericho, by some estimations, is the oldest city in the world. It's the oldest inhabited city in the world. Anyway, you do have the sense of going down to Bethel. Once you get there, you go up. And, that may be, have the feeling. However, the other aspect of it is, it could be speaking in spiritual terms that Beit El, now a center of idol worship, may have felt like you're declining in relation to Yahweh. Kind of like going to Las Vegas. You know, you feel like you're...
Exactly. That was where I was coming from. I wanted to know if that was the possibility. Because I know we're talking about going up in elevation, but... could it possibly be that we're talking in a spiritual sense here? Are we looking in more in the sod than in the peshat here?
Could be. It's kind of like...
Okay, well, it for sure is that we're at a break, so we'll be right back.
And I pray, don't take me soon, because I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know something, either Lord will turn around, because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we know what I fight no more, there'll be no more.
dum doo doo dum dum. Come a come a dum doo doo dum dum. Come a come a dum doo doo dum dum. Keep in Torah's a joy too.
Welcome back now, folks, to the last segment for today. We're talking about the book of 2 Kings and the ascension, if we get there during this last segment, from the earth to wherever it is that Eliyahu goes in a whirlwind. So where were we? I think we interrupted Rob at this point. So, Rob, go ahead and finish up what you were talking about, and then we'll get back to the story. When you get your mic on. There we go.
Yeah. Yeah. What we were talking about is that where is Gilgal in relation to Beit El? And I think it's clear that we're talking about, instead of a geographical sense, this feeling of going down. And Beit El has become a center of idol worship. It may or may not have had that original mission to be that, but it has become that. There's argument whether the golden calves there were meant to represent deity itself or was meant to be carrying deity upon their back. But whatever the case is, people have begun to venerate the golden calves. So you have this kind of a sense of going down, spiritually speaking, as Mark Petron was suggesting. Much like we have this feeling of going into a den of iniquity when you go into, say, Las Vegas or someplace like that.
Okay, yeah.
But you're technically, you do feel like you're going down when you're going from Gilgal to Bethel, and Bethel kind of sets up on a hill when you get there, and that could be because as you're going towards the Dead Sea, you always have this feeling of going down. Even though, like when you're traveling from Galilee to Jerusalem, it feels like you're going down the whole time, even when you get to Jerusalem. But you've actually started to come back up, and but you don't get that sense. So anyway, I think that's what we're talking about here.
Okie dokie.
Shall we read on in all right. That case?
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. So, well, we were somewhere in the story of
where
Elijah.
Where are we reading from?
And I think we're about verse 5, so everybody basically knows that this is the day, and Elijah is heading out, and Elisha isn't going to let him go alone. So, now the sons of the prophet who were at Jericho came to Elisha, and they said to him, "Do you know that Yahuwah will take away your master from over you today?" So he answered, "Yes, I do. Keep silent." So he says that more than once. Then Eliyahu says to him, "Stay here, please, for Yahuwah sent me on to the Jordan." So he's got another mission. But he said, "Again, as Yahuwah lives and as your soul lives, I'll not leave you." So the two of them went on. So now we're at the second of the places are going to go, and 50 men of the sons of the prophets went and stood facing them at a distance, while the two of them stood by the Jordan River, the Jordan. And now it says, Eliyahu, Elijah, took his mantle, rolled it up, and struck the water, and it was divided this way and that, so that the two of them crossed over on dry ground. Well, gee, there's an interesting scriptural metaphor. We've never seen that happen before. Go ahead, MP, why don't you take us where you'd like to go?
Okay, I'd like to go back to verse 3 because I've only covered verses 1 and 2 so far.
Okay.
Zomer has an interesting comment on this particular trek that these guys are going to make. It says, Eliyahu's journey and Elisha, with Elisha, took them to some of the key spiritual sites in the land, including the first Israelite encampment after the original entry, Gilgal, also having the connotation of Gilgul, which means reincarnation, and Beit El, where Abraham and Yaakov had prayed long before Jeroboam had made his golden calves. So in verse 3, we see why Elishua, that is Elisha, would not leave Eliyahu's side at this time. The other prophets of the school came out to him, and they asked him if he knew that Eliyahu, what his intent was, to be taken from him as his head and to leave Elisha in charge of the prophet's school, basically the chief of the prophets of Israel. And he answered, I know, hush up. Now the Hebrew for King James head is 72:18, Rosh, to begin or to animate, the meaning here being to lead or to go first. It's preceded by a conjunction, Al, 59:21, meaning above or over and over or upon. And by the way, when I said hush up above, that's exactly what the Hebrew says. It says chasha, basically shh, literally to refrain from expression or movement and to be absolutely still. So in verse 4, Eliyahu again asks Elisha to stay behind in Beit El while he treks down to Jericho, which was situated on the mountainside above Gilgal, and they passed on their way down to Beit El. Okay? And again, Elisha says that he will stay with his Rebbe. So they came to Jericho. Hebrew for come is bo, which means to come or to go to a desirable place. And Jericho was just such a place. Yerach means to make an impact. That's what the root word of Jericho is, Yerach. Now in verse 5, Elishua gets the same treatment from the prophets that he got in Beit El. Do you know? And he told him, hush. Okay. Chasha. But then in verse 6, Eliyahu once again asks Elisha to hang with his buds. Yah wants me to go down to Yarden, which is from the same Hebrew root, by the way, go down as Yerat, Yerad rather, to descend, which is exactly what he's doing in the physical, going down in elevation to the river Yarden, which is at the bottom of the Rift Valley in these parts and well below sea level. But the last time we saw the word Yerad, he was physically going up to Beit El, which is that's what brought on the question that took up the last 7 or 8 minutes of the last half hour. Azamra on the prophets in the various cities and towns says this, the sons of the prophets who came out of Beit El and Jericho in verses 3 and 5 were not necessarily their biological offspring, but rather the students of the prophets. For from here we learn that students are called children, and likewise it says, and you shall diligently teach them to your children, in Deuteronomy 6:7. And just as students are called children, so the teacher is called a father, as it says in verse 12 that we're coming up to, and Elisha watched and he called, my father, my father. Okay, so that's what I got on verses 3 through 6, and if you want me to go on, I will.
Well, I'll let Rob decide.
Okay.
What do you think?
Let's go on.
Okay, he's ready.
Okay. Okay, verses 7 and 8, we see the Yarden crossing. In verse 7, 50 of Eliyahu's, and I assume he was the president of the overall organization of the prophetic schools in the major cities of the land, Talmudim, came out to Jericho to try to witness what they assume would be the last sight of Eliyahu. Azamra says this about all these prophets and their sons. It says, the fact that there were bands of students of prophecy in Beth El and Jericho teaches you that was not a city in Israel that did not have prophets. Okay, and we're talking, obviously we're talking about Yehuda. Beit El is actually in the tribe of Benjamin. So anyway, so Eliyahu and Elisha are standing at the west bank of Yarden with the local prophetic school watching from a distance. Eliyahu, in verse 8, took off his mantle, folded it, I assume neatly, and struck the water with it. The word KJV translates mantle is adir, which speaks of power. From H142, adar, which means to exert power or status. It was probably a cloak of some kind, but the idea is of special power gifted from Yehovah. One does not generally fold his power to exert it. Most would think that when one exerts power, he unfolds it. When Eliyahu struck the water, it parted before him, and Elisha, and they walked across dry, not even mud squishing between the toes. There is a difference between this miracle and the one the nation witnessed during the Exodus in Exodus 14, 16, and 22. There, the word translated dry, the word ground is actually added by the translators, is yabasa, from the Hebrew 3001, yabash, to firm up or dry. Here, the word is haraba, from the Hebrew harav, to parch or lose vitality. And it speaks of the riverbed actually being dry as soon as the water was made to stop flowing over the prophet's path. When Israel went across the Red Sea, I don't think they ever touched the bottom of the sea. That Yehovah either carried Israel across, like he did the priests who shouldered the ark in transport, or placed a barrier between them and the sea bottom. That's what I personally believe he did. That they were walking on something other than the sea bottom, because there was no mush that they were walking through. Paro tried to take advantage of that barrier and almost caught Israel's stragglers before Yehovah removed the miracle as the last Israeli foot touched solid land, and Paro and his army sank into the muck of the sea and of the sea floor. Horses couldn't move, chariots' wheels broke off. Both are pretty incredible miracles, but the one in Exodus 14 is much more impressive and satisfying to me. Exodus 14 is just great. Paro is just about to catch him, and all of a sudden that barrier is removed, and he sinks into the mud, and water comes down and drowns them all. I love that story. Anyway, that's what I got through verse 8.
Okay, Rob?
Okay. So that brings us then to the, for me, let's go back to the seventh verse.
Please.
So the two of them went on. 50 of the school of the prophets went and stood watching from a distance. And while they stood by the Yordan, then Eliyahu took off his talit, rolled it up, and struck the water with it. And the water divided itself to the left and to the right, so that they crossed on dry ground. After they had crossed, Eliyahu said to Elisha, "Tell me, what can I do for you before I'm taken away from you?" And Elisha said, "Please, let a double portion of your spirit be on me." He replied, "You have requested a hard thing. Nevertheless, if you see me when I am taken from you, you'll get what you asked for. But if not, you won't." So Eliyahu took his talit, rolled it up like a staff, and he smote the waters, which separated. The prophets passed through the river on dry ground, walking with Elisha between the parted flood. Eliyahu asked his disciple if he could do anything for him before Yahweh took him away. And Elisha replied that he would like to ask for a double measure of the Holy Spirit of his master. Eliyahu assured him that although his wish was no small thing, it would come true if Elisha merited seeing his master go up into heaven. Elisha was already appointed as Elijah's successor. This is indicative of the property, inheritance, customs of the time, where the oldest son received twice as much of the father's inheritance as each of the younger sons. In this interpretation, Elisha is asking that he may be seen as the rightful heir and successor of Eliyahu over the rest of the school of the prophets.
And that is a really important point. So, yeah, I want to make sure we emphasize that, because I think it is a fitting reference. It's one of those things that everybody that's been through the Torah understands the double portion idea with respect to the oldest son.
Yes. And so here, we have to remember that the school of the prophets had been disciples of Eliyahu. And it's interesting because we've met the school of the prophets in Beit El. We've met the school of the prophets in Jericho. So there's this kind of a franchise that Eliyahu has built. These schools being around, scattered about Israel. And so...
if only he had television back then.
They're all wanting to be successors of Eliyahu's revelatory gift. But it's Elisha that has been his scribe, his disciple, his son. And as a son, and this is Eliyahu has made it clear that he had adopted Elisha, not just as a Talmid or a student, but as a son that he never had. And so as a son, he has the right to a double portion of the inheritance. Now, the school of prophets, those prophets will receive an anointing from Eliyahu's ministry. There's no qualms about that. And that's how they knew that he was going to be taken up. Obviously, they are walking in the office of prophet. So they're already have received an anointing from Eliyahu's ministry. But it's Elisha as his son, his adopted son, that has a right to the double portion of the inheritance. And all that Eliyahu has to offer is his talit, his staff, and his anointing.
Okay, well, and wait a second. Now, Rob, since you're going there, that offers an interesting question. Why, given that it seems like a natural thing, because we already know that Elisha is the designated heir, he is, in fact, the son in that sense. Why is this a hard thing in that case? It would seem to be obvious.
Well, because Eliyahu doesn't have the power to give it. In other words, he's saying, okay, that's not going to be easy because it's not mine. I don't have it to give. So, but if you're here when the translation happens, then you'll get it. You'll get the residue falling on you. And so, in other words, he's saying, be here when it happens, and the residue you'll get.
Okay. Well, and to the extent that Elisha seems to have kind of had an understanding about that anyway, he ain't leaving. He's going with him. So, you know, it makes sense, at least.
Mm. And if he knows that if he leaves, someone else will fill in the vacuum. And so he doesn't want to leave because all he has of his master, and remember, he's let go of everything. He told his mom and dad goodbye as though he were dead. And that was the heartbreaking thing. That's why he wanted to tell them all goodbye, because they didn't know if they were going to see each other again. And he's been with Elijah or Eliyahu all ever since. And as I've said, it hadn't been easy.
Okay.
So all he has to get from his master, his spiritual father, is his talit, his staff, and his anointing.
And the double portion. Well, okay, so we've only got about 5 minutes. Let's make sure we at least talk about the story. There's a lot more to it, of course, but I do want to go through this part where after they had crossed over, he asked the question, asked for the double portion. You've asked for a hard thing, so let's see if it's going to happen. And then verse 11 says, then it happened, as they continued on and talked, that suddenly a chariot of fire appeared with horses of fire and separated the two of them. And Eliyahu went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Mm. So I got a chariot of fire taken up by a whirlwind with Eliyahu in it. Now, Elisha, of course, he sees it says in verse 12, and he cried out, my father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen. So he saw him no more, and he took hold of his own clothes and tore them in two pieces. He also took up the mantle of Eliyahu that had fallen from him, and he went back and he stood by the bank of the Jordan. Let me go ahead and read the next couple of verses. Then he took the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him, and he struck the water. And he said, where is Yahuwah El of Elijah? And when he had also had struck the water, it was divided this way and that, and Elisha crossed over. So let's pause there. I'll go to MP, and you don't get cut off. Mark, you got a couple minutes. Go ahead. Take us through this part of the story anyway. And then, if necessary, we'll back and fill next week.
We're going to go back and fill next week?
Just go where you want to go. And I know you're going to want to back and fill anyway, so there we go. Yeah.
We see the offer and acceptance of the contract between the prophets and their Elohim. Eliyahu, in verses 9 and 10, offered a choice to Elishua, who had made a counteroffer that Eliyahu couldn't lawfully grant because it was not his to grant. What they had done, when they had gotten across and were completely out of earshot for the still watching prophets, Eliyahu asked Elisha what kindness he could do him before he was taken away from him. Elishua asked a double portion of Eliyahu's spirit. And I think that is what the mantle represents. As I said in the opening paragraph of this study, that the mantle represents the spirituality of the guy that has it. So the father's property is divided up to his sons equally. If he had three sons, the property was divided up into four parts. One part for each, plus one extra portion for the firstborn. The double portion, in other words, was the right of the firstborn when the father died. That is what Elishua is asking. And TSK has this on the double portion. It says this probably refers to the law respecting the firstborn who had a double portion of the property of his father. As Elisha may have considered himself as the firstborn of Eliyah, so he requested a double portion of the spiritual influence. Now, Elisha didn't ask for twice the spirit of Eliyahu, but the authority as the firstborn. In other words, to be the president of the prophetic schools of Israel, basically, because all of the schools of Israel were under the authority of Eliyahu. As we'll see, Jehovah's answer seems to be yes to both. Zamra on the double portion says, if the students of the prophets are their sons, Elisha asked of Eliyahu as the parting gift to be given a double portion of your spirit upon me, alluding to the double portion of the firstborn son. Now, Eliyahu's answer was exactly what he could answer. Basically, in a Mark paraphrase, he said, you've asked more than I can grant, but if you see me when I am taken from you, that will signify that Jehovah has granted your request. If not, oh well, it's out of my hands. Also, from Azamra, they said, we do indeed see in the ensuing narratives that Elisha, that he performed double the miracles of Elijah. Everything that Elisha did, he did in the power of his master, and this power came into him precisely because he was present with Eliyah when Eliyah ascended and the chariot of fire drawn by the horses of fire. That's the absolute truth. Then verse 11 to 12, and we've only got about a minute, so let me do a little bit. As they were walking along and talking, perhaps still in the sight of the Talmudim on the west bank, a chariot of fire with horses of fire parted them. Perhaps to protect Elishua, the whirlwind caught Eliyahu away. The word translated chariot is not Merkava, his second of which is the paro who made Yeshua, Yosef rather, to, this is, the, I'm sorry, this is the second, I screwed this, that paragraph up. Anyway, in the word Rechav, which is the basics of Rachav, to ride, and it refers to anything on or in which one can ride. So Yehovah sent a ride for Eliyahu, maybe a Rolls Royce of gold, who knows. After all the time, well, that would have been if it was Joel, whatever his name is. After all the times of Eliyahu had given Elisha a chance to not tag along and been rebuffed, Yehovah probably figured it didn't.
Okay, well, I figure it's time for us to pack it up. We'll talk about the rest of this story in chapter 2 next week. Thanks, guys. Shalom, folks.